There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits of today's show from Monday, December the 23rd. We have a special report on the UAE's booming video game market.
The rules have changed. There's a fine line between right and wrong. And somewhere in the shadows, they send us in to find it.
That is Call of Duty Modern Warfare, came out earlier this year, and 3 days ago, Activision, the company behind it, revealed that it had generated more than $1 billion, with a B, dollars worth of revenue. Globally, the industry's worth $148 billion a year, putting it by some measures ahead of Hollywood. Here in the region, the Middle East and Africa, Tencent, the Chinese tech giant, says it's worth $4.8 billion this year. It's going to be $6 billion by 2021. That's growth of about 12% a year.
We're not playing Pac-Man anymore, are we?
We are not playing. Well, some of us are playing Pac-Man anymore, but many of us are playing video games like Modern Warfare on a console, Xbox, PlayStation, but also it's those pesky games on our smartphone with the in-app purchases where they get you one dirham at a time.
You've got children, haven't you?
I have indeed, and the multiple iTunes bills to prove it. We've been looking into this in some detail. First of all, with Nick Rago from Tech Radar Middle East. He's a journalist there and tech expert. And we asked him, just how big is gaming here in the UAE?
Gaming in the UAE certainly has grown, you know, exponentially over the couple of years. I remember when, you know, back in the 90s, we would go to LAN cafes and play StarCraft and Age of Empires and Counter-Strike against friends on, you know, a networking gaming scene. And, you know, to some extent, we're still doing that, but we're doing that on a much bigger scale. We're playing with people across Asia, America, continental Europe, anywhere else in the world. That's kind of where it's been. And here in the UAE, there are loads of events, there are loads of opportunities for gamers to show their skills in, you know, professional esports tournaments. People are saying, you know, esports is a multi-billion dollar industry. And, you know, what's really incredible about that is that the Middle East specifically is being recognized as that kind of platform where there are good gamers. So whether you're looking at the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or any other, you know, areas of the Middle East, there are gamers all across the region that are vying for that spotlight, that are vying for that attention, and want to be able to bring that kind of fame and glory to their home countries.
Yeah, and we're going to be hearing from one of them very shortly. But before we do, this is Nick's predictions for 2020. Gaming-wise,
I think definitely with the release of the next generation of consoles for both Xbox and PlayStation, that's something that we're definitely going to be looking at the horizon to see exactly how these companies can harness all of that raw power that these consoles will basically showcase. On the mobile front, again, there's going to be a huge increase of people who are getting more powerful smartphones at much cheaper prices, which means that they can play much more demanding games. And it just generally will be on the rise. I think, like I said before, gaming transcends all boundaries of age, nationality, gender, and, you know, if you can follow basic instructions on a game, whether you think it's, you know, Candy Crush even, that makes you a gamer because you are playing a game for enjoyment and for skills, and that's something that, you know, nobody else can take away from you.
Snake on the Nokia does not qualify, Brandy Scott.
We've been chatting this morning to a man who has been there, done that, and got the T-shirt. Actually got the T-shirt because you can buy one, can't you? How much are they going for at the moment?
I could tell you that. This is Klaus Kajetski, and he's the founder of Yala Esports, which is it organises teams for competitive computer games. And conceptually, there's a whole bunch of leaps that I've got to take there. But anyway, what I can tell you is that they've got a shop on their website. It's a Dubai-based company. He's a Finnish entrepreneur. Yala Esports. And they look like, you know, those garish cycling jerseys?
Yep.
Our boss is a keen cyclist. You know those lovely cycling jerseys that middle-aged men wear around Al Qudra?
Nothing like a bit of Lycra. Mm. Yep, go for it.
On a 50-odd-year-old Australian yes. chap. Yes. Well, they look like those. It's kind of purple and different shades of purple, figure-hugging. It's got all the sponsors' names on it, like you would have on the cycling jerseys. The great thing is you can have your nickname on the back. You can get them customised. So for $54.14, you, Brandy Scott, can be...
Brandy... The Blade Scott, I don't know. We've been speaking this morning to Klaus Kajetski. He is the founder of Yala Esports. And it's interesting you mentioned the sponsors because that's one of the big things, isn't it? We were asking him whether or not you can really make a living by playing esports.
First of all, like there is the very short, so to say, career when you're an esports athlete. That is pretty rough. I mean, you know, look at, let's say, I don't know, top modeling, and you have your prime years. It's exactly the same in esports. It's starting from, let's say, 16 to, I don't know, somewhere 22, when you're like from a physical point of view, your reflex skills are at the top and so on. But beyond that, what we try to do...
How old are you, Klaus?
I'm 33, you know.
And you're past it.
I'm way past that. But here's a perfect example. I'm still in esports and in the career. I had my short period of professional gaming from 16 to about 19 or so. But so this is exactly what we do at Yalla Esports. So besides training their mechanical skills in the game, we also train their personal branding, make sure they have their YouTube channels, their social media channels intact. They become influencers. Maybe then after 22, they can become coaches or analysts, or maybe they can be the one speaking on the stage, the commentators, and so forth and so on. And then, you know, when eventually maybe they can be a team owner like me and start their own team and bring their expertise into the next generation. And all of this, by the way, is viable career options.
What a world. Washed up in the e-games world at 33.
But I mean, he says washed up at 22.
Yeah.
You've got about 6 years where your reactions are quick enough between the age of 16 and 22. After that, you're done.
There are going to be parents of 16-year-olds who are listening to this shaking their head thinking, reactions? What reactions?
Can't get him out of bed before 11 o'clock in the morning.
We were having a look at the Forbes list of the 10 highest earning YouTubers. Half of them are gamers making more than $10 million a year. And we asked Klaus, is that happening here? How much are they really making in this region?
Well, in this region, obviously, we are maybe not at that kind of numbers yet. It's all it takes is really, you know, you win one big tournament, for example, and you can like skyrocket, for example. But what I'm looking at more at Yalla Esports is also to build that kind of sustainability. Like you know, you start small, you maybe do like one thing for a couple $1,000s. But if you start getting these like on a monthly basis, I mean, you know, like when I was 16 years old, I didn't make $2,000 a month. Like that's big money for a 16-year-old kid.
I'm looking at the teams that Yalla Esports has got, and the name sports suggests that they're playing basketball or tennis, but it's not. They're often quite violent games. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege suggests there might be some violence there. Fortnite, we know all about that. Call of Duty Black Ops, again, it's a kind of warfare type game. Clash Royale, there's some beating up going on there. So it's quite often these war-type games. Many different ones, but that's the kind of thing we're talking about.
And we spoke this morning to a clinical psychologist, Dr. Thraya Kanafani. But before we did, we said to Klaus, we're about to speak to a clinical psychologist about all the reasons that parents worry about their kids gaming too much. He's been doing it for half of his life. Do you think there are issues?
To put things into perspective, like you do anything too much, like excessive of anything is harmful. Yes, I agree. But, you know, what's the difference of a kid coming home from school or after school playing, you know, 5 hours of football on the backyard or 5 hours of gaming?
And we spoke to Dr. Thraya, as I mentioned there. She's a clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. And we asked her what she was seeing, what she felt, and what we knew research-wise the impact of gaming is on young people.
You know, there's no real correlation between or strong correlation between aggression and aggressive behavior and violent video game playing. However, we have noticed that there has been, you know, in terms of people playing a lot, there's been like a decrease in terms of empathy levels, an increase in terms of being addicted to the kind of games that they're playing, as well as becoming socially isolated in physical life rather than, you know, online life. They're quite socially connected, but you know, there are a lot of problems that come with that in and of itself because you don't really know who you're talking to, the information that you're giving out, things like that. At times, kids or even, you know, young adults can confuse reality with fantasy. Their school performance can be reduced because of time. There's also new research that came out of the University of Montreal in Canada that shows that if they start, if children start way too young when it comes to video gaming, it could reduce the amount of gray matter that's built up in the brain. However, there are a lot of benefits as well. So things like, you know, it increases problem solving and logic skills, hand-eye coordination, fine motor and spatial skills for children. It also helps them kind of quickly think on their feet, you know, create strategy, anticipate kind of patterns. It helps with memory skills. So as you can see, there are kind of two sides to the coin here. It's you know, there are a lot of benefits and there are a lot of downsides. But I think the main takeaway of all of these research studies is that in moderation, video gaming can be fine. But in extremes, like anything else in life, it could be quite detrimental.
Which is great for people who can actually do moderation. My waistline would suggest that I probably don't fit into that category. Dr. Thiriya Kenafani, the clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking business changes. We are taking stock, as you do this time of the year, having a look at the biggest changes in 2019 that are going to influence what we're all doing in 2020. We are joined in the studio by Rebecca Kelly, lawyer and partner at the firm Morgan Lewis. Let's talk about foreign ownership. Because this is a law that has been long awaited. Actually, November 2018 is when we got the sign-off that there would be areas onshore that would have 100% foreign ownership. But it was July this year that we actually got the list from the Cabinet of which activities, the business activities is the official term, but which sectors, if you like, including agriculture, manufacturing, logistics, hospitality, food, IT and communications, would actually be able to be 100% owned. What have we seen happen since then?
We've seen some confusion around that because not all of the – just because you're active in one of these activities doesn't necessarily mean that your particular industry or your particular entity is going to be liberalised in relation to the Cabinet resolution. Now, the Cabinet resolution came in July, as you mentioned, and what it basically said is that there are 13 sectors of which if you are licensed or you wish to be licensed in those sectors, you may be eligible for 100% foreign ownership if you have activities onshore in the UAE. Now, what that actually means in practice is that you would have to satisfy the other criteria under the Cabinet resolution. And we haven't seen necessarily a flood of activity in this area because the criteria is, whilst it's clear, there is still a large capital investment that any of these entities would need to undertake in order to establish themselves onshore as well. It's not as simple as just transferring your existing license into a different entity and then being eligible for 100% foreign ownership. There is actually other criteria. So I would say that moving into 2020, 12 months after, so by July next year, I would say that we would have a lot more action in respect of licences that have been granted by the regulatory authorities with 100% foreign ownership.
And the other big one that we've been talking about this month particularly, we've seen changes to bankruptcy or insolvency laws, two different things, I know. Let's start with the personal laws because that's the most recent. In November, we saw a personal insolvency set of regulations come in. What's that going to do for the economy, for the country and for people living here?
Well, the fundamental difference between the bankruptcy law, which was enacted in 2016, and the insolvency regime, which is 2019, is that the insolvency law deals with individuals. You're not going to avail of any of the legislative protections under that law if you are a trader at all. It is for personal liability. And the reason that we have it, and it's an unusual piece of legislation because worldwide, those particular provisions are usually contained within a chapter of a bankruptcy law that deals with personal debt. But because the bankruptcy law didn't deal with personal debt, there was this gap. And that is why we have the insolvency regime. Now, what it allows people to do is to enter into agreements with anybody that they owe money to. That's the basic fundamental principle of what it is. Prior to this piece of legislation being enacted and prior to the bankruptcy law being enacted, if you were a debtor in this jurisdiction, you could actually face criminal prosecution. And so by removing that, what you're actually doing is engaging with your debtor and actually getting to a point where there is a chance of recovery under that particular law and under your under the debt due, rather than having it a situation where anybody that owes money has no recourse to say, well, if I owe $100,000 or 100,000 dirhams, I can't pay it off on the terms that we've agreed. Is there a better way that we can extend the terms or that we can extend the repayment mechanism? And this particular piece of legislation allows individuals to do that.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that there will be no consequences.
No, that's right. A debt is a debt, and it just means that the provisions around when it's due or the consequences for the individual may not necessarily mean that they go that there are criminal prosecutions.
Very quickly, we've only got a couple more minutes with you. I'm having a look at the list of things that have been gazetted, the only verb that we are allowing that's a non-verb in this studio. We've got data privacy changes, we've got anti-money laundering changes, and we've got medical negligence.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, medical negligence, because again, if I use the insolvency analogy, consequences for medical practitioners in this jurisdiction where there has been any medical negligence claimed have been limited to a 2008 piece of legislation. So now they've enacted in the past year the executive regulations, which actually for the first time define what gross medical negligence is. Obviously, the negligence is still attached to the individual who performed any of the services, but what it does is it allows for medical practitioners to have clarity around when and how they would be held liable in the event of gross medical negligence.
And thanks for joining us. Rebecca Kelly is a partner at the law firm Morgan Lewis. We look forward to speaking to you in 2020.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We're starting to look back at the best of 2019. You're simply the best. Better than all the rest. Better than anyone. Looking at the best, but also the worst of 2019. Starting, I guess it has to be, Brandy Scott, with you, of the best book of the year. And I would say that we have both decided that neither of our books are allowed on this list.
No, they're not. No, they're
Although,
not.
If they were, of course, they would be. But your book of the year?
My book of the year is a fiction book. There were a couple of non-fiction books that I liked. But for me, my focus was very firmly on fiction. And in the last couple of months, I had the joy of discovering a new author that I had never read before, who has a fantastic backlist. And it made me happy for a couple of reasons. Number one, it made me happy because there's the fantasticness of finding an author and then suddenly realizing that they've got a lot of work that you haven't read, so you can just binge read over the holiday, which is amazing. Number two, it made me happy because it's part of a wider trend for books to be picked up, championed and made into television series. Conviction by Dennis Mina, which is my pick, is going to be a television. I think it's been picked up by the Apple TV guys. The other thing I really loved about it was it shone a light on one of my other big favourite things that has kept me company this year, and that has been the true crime podcast, of which I am a junkie, because that's what this book is about. It's called Conviction by Dennis Mina. It is a Scottish crime book. It's an example of tartan noir, which is a rising genre. This is Denise talking about the normalization of female protagonists or female lead characters in crime.
I think female protagonists in crime fiction are reaching a really interesting stage because of programmes like The Killing. Because it used to be all you could talk about if you had a female protagonist was the fact that they were female. And then all you could talk about was the fact that they weren't treated the same as the men. And now you can have a female protagonist and it's almost incidental that they're female because people don't comment on their gender all the time. And it just becomes another slight factor, but they're not tied down the way they used to be into this corner of being a female protagonist. And I think a lot of people who have female protagonists are women writers, and it just feels more realistic to write about a woman than to write about a man in the central role. But it doesn't all have to be about, you know, she discovered the murderer because she happened to go and get her legs waxed.
She's fabulously funny, and it's also the first book in a really long time that I have read in two sittings. Literally finished it in 48 hours.
How many pages?
Oh, it'll be about 300.
Okay.
I've got it on my Kindle, and I'm going to go and buy a physical copy because I want to go through it with a pen. And as an example of crime craft, it's absolutely magnificent, and I want to figure out how she did what she did. So if you are looking for a good read, a good escapism read this Christmas, and you are a fiction type of person, Conviction by Dennis Mina, that's the one.
You know what? Picking up on what you say there, both my wife and I this holiday, my holiday reading was genuinely Not Bad People by Brandy Scott. But the other book that my wife and I both read was one of the Stella Rimington spy novels.
Ooh.
Stella Rimington is the former head of the British Secret Service, MI5, I think it's called. And the lead character, they're James Bond type novels, but her lead character is not James Bond or Luke Carlton. It's Liz Carlyle, and it's a strong female lead. But again, listening to Denise, that resonated because her femininity is not...
She just happens to be a
bird. ...does not define her character. Yeah. What's that test that they have in fiction and movies?
The Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test, which, remind us, is?
Whether or not there are two female characters who have a conversation that is basically not about a bloke.
Right. And Denise's novel, I guess, passes that test.
Absolutely.
With flying colours.
It's just been one of the pure best books that I've read in a very long time.
My favourite book of the year, you will not be surprised to hear, is a book about economics. It's called... But I think you'd quite like it. And I'll tell you why, because the book is called Narrative Economics, How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events by Professor Robert Shiller, who has a Nobel Prize in Economics.
Oh, okay. Do you know what? I'm going to buy it now. Keep talking.
It's brilliant. And his thesis is that the global economy is not driven by the decision of central banks or by major political events or by elections or by building walls or by trade deals or trade wars. It's by stories. And the stories that we, as the 7 billion people who live in the economy, believe and act upon. And as I said, 2013, this guy won the Nobel Prize for Economics. So there is a lot of substance to this. And it's based loosely on the 100-year-old, more or less, concept that John Maynard Keynes invented, that the economy is driven by animal spirits. If 7 billion people believe that there's a recession happening, they'll stop spending and it becomes self-fulfilling. You'll have a recession. If 7 billion people think that everything is awesome and everything's booming, they'll go out, they'll buy a new car, and the economy will boom. And he gives many, many examples. He says the most recent example of narrative economics is Bitcoin. That story has gone viral in the way that the Ebola virus has gone viral. And you plot it on a graph and it follows a very, very similar pattern. And he says it's these stories that we have in our heads that we tell to each other that drive the booms and busts of the global economy.
Which is so interesting because I was reading a book recently, a craft book, again, about how to write books, called Hardwired for Narrative. And it looks into the fact, why do we read? Fiction particularly, why do we read? Okay, non-fiction, we read to find out about things, fine. But fiction, why do we sit down and spend hours and hours and hours reading about people that someone's just made up that never existed and things that never happened? Like, biologically, why would you do that and why is it even enjoyable? And it goes back to us sitting around a fire telling a story about how your uncle was nearly eaten by a saber-toothed tiger so that you learn what you would do if you were being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. And it's survival. It's literally a survival strategy. That is why we are hardwired to enjoy reading and to enjoy that narrative. So it makes absolute sense that it would also work from a marketing and a sales point of view.
And he borrows from fields such as sociology, from marketing, as well as literature and history, this idea that the narrative is incredibly powerful in motivating human actions. This is he, Professor Robert Shiller, winner of the 2013 prize in economics from the Nobel Commission in Sweden, explaining the concept of narrative economics and why it's so important.
The economics profession has to respect the importance of spreading narratives that spread like a contagion. The example that really comes to mind here in the United States is Donald J. Trump. Part of the theme of Donald J. Trump is think big, live large. In other words, live like Donald Trump. You got to show off. You have to be rich and impressive. That is a theme that at sometimes looks immoral, looks bad. But we now have a national leader who's saying, no, this is good.
Professor Robert Shiller, his book Narrative Economics is my book of the year.
Let's go to the movies.
Ladies first.
Right. I have both a not movie and a movie, because there was a movie that I thought was going to be my movie of the year, but it was not my movie of the year.
This gorge is where all lions come to find their roar.
All lions? Even my dad?
Even Mufasa came here when he was your age. Refused to leave until his roar could be heard above the rim.
All the way up there?
That's when you know you found it. With a little practice, you'll never be called a cub again.
Watch this.
Lion King was my favourite movie when I was at school. Absolutely loved it. The animation, I've seen it in French, I've seen it in Spanish, I've seen the musical in Spanish, Loa Leon. Really excited about the new Lion King. No. So no.
Why? What was different about it?
It's just weird. The animatronic, I mean, I know Cats is currently the semi-lion film getting in the neck at the moment for its CGI-ness. I'm not a CGI fan. I'm just not. I wanted to be open-minded about this. I just sat there and I found the animals that were human but not human to be just quite frankly weird.
I'm looking on Rotten Tomatoes and it kind of agrees with you. 53% on the tomatometer. Anything below 60% is a splat. So the thumbs down for The Lion King, even though it did more than $1 billion at the box office.
And you mess with people's childhood at their peril. However, my movie of the year, which had no real discernible plot, I didn't care. It was brilliant.
I'm Rick Dalton. It's my pleasure, Mr. Schwartz.
Call me Marvin. Put it there. That's your son?
No, that's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
Last night, we watched a Rick Dalton double feature. All the shooting. I love that stuff, you know, the killing.
A lot of killing.
Robert De Niro, Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Is it good?
Absolutely cracking. And I say that, we've been talking about narrative and the importance of a narrative arc this morning. There is no narrative arc in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There is a loose kind of almost plot sort of woven in around the Manson killings in the background, but not really. However, there is still emotion, there is still pathos, and it doesn't matter. It just goes to show that if you're Quentin Tarantino, you can take the rule book, you can rip it up, and it will still work, and that's absolutely what he's done.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is Brandy's movie of the year. I'm going to cheat with my movie of the year. It won an Oscar in 2019, although it was actually released very, very late last year. And it's a kid's movie. It's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And you may think, oh, superhero movie, you've got to be joking. But it won an Oscar this year, and it won the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. And it's brilliant because the animation is like nothing you're used to seeing at the moment. So much of the animation we see at the moment is really slick, 50 frames per second. It's almost photorealistic. But this was...
Unless you're a lion or a cat.
Thank you. But this was done in a very retro 1950s, 1960s style. It was done as if it was done with very loose hand-drawn animation, and it just works so well. It's got this beautiful retro feel to it, and the music is awesome. Post Malone does a lot of the music, who's the world's biggest pop star at the moment. It's a really, really good movie, and it just shows you that not all superhero movies have to be formulaic and the same. They took a really, really big risk with this one because the animation is completely different to the style that audiences are used to at the moment, that really slick, cutting-edge fast processor graphics. And for that, I absolutely love it. Real retro feel to it. And it's a fabulous movie. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, my movie of 2019.
Song of the year. This is mine, and there's a reason for it. Actually, a business reason for it. I loved it anyway, but I was reading a really interesting Quartz article over the weekend explaining why we're listening to certain music at the moment rather than others, and it made me love it even more.
I'm the bad guy. Duh.
So, Billie Eilish, absolutely fantastic for a number of reasons. Again, ripping up the rule book, young, funky, exciting woman out there doing exactly what she wants. Love all of that. But then was looking at Quartz this weekend, which was talking about how the technology that we listen to music on shapes the music that we're listening to.
Okay.
And there have been a couple of books written about this. One by the guy who was the Talking Heads frontman, David Byrne, wrote a book a couple of years ago called How Music Works.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he pointed out back in 2012, listen to me, back in 2012, he pointed out that the way you listen to music affects what music you like. And he was talking about keyboards, because he was saying that keyboards work really well with digital music because they digitize well. Unsurprisingly. And he was saying that medieval European music is very simple in the way that its notes work, because clashing notes sound awful in cathedrals. Trumpets, really big in jazz, because people were playing jazz in noisy bars and you needed an instrument that would kind of cut through the talking and you could still hear it. Really fascinating. Enter Billie Eilish. We are listening to music at the moment on AirPods. Tiny little buds in your head. Hence the rise of whispery music that sounds like one person is just whispering straight into your ear because they actually are.
Ah, hence the Billie Eilish very softly spoken, almost whispering poet style wouldn't work if you were listening 20 years ago on a fairly dodgy radio, for example.
No, and they're saying that the rise in, if you look at the Selena Gomez recent hit, Look at Her Now, there's part of the chorus that, again, she goes all a bit whispery. It's like she's talking just to you, very quietly, directly into your ears. And it's the way that we are listening now and the technology that we are listening on that makes that style very warm, very intimate, and makes it work.
It's also reducing the length of songs, isn't it? They're now below 3 minutes because you don't get the money from Spotify if people don't listen to 75%, I think it is, of your song. Hence, you have shorter songs.
Yeah.
There's none of Malcolm Taylor's Van de Graaff generator 23-minute songs on Spotify. It just doesn't work.
Yep, and there's a lot more. I mean, and I'm not sure I agree with this. Quartz also went into the idea of confessional music, sort of saying Post Malone again, Drake and a lot of the other. There's a lot of talky, confessional inner dialogues. I don't think that's new, though. I think that country and Western has been doing sort of, you know, confessional barrel soul. In fact, you could argue that music has for decades. But they think that because other people aren't hearing what we're listening to, we are more comfortable listening to more and more and more personal, raw, warts and all. Think Lord, for example. We're more comfortable listening to that because it's, again, it's literally someone is whispering a secret straight into your ear.
Zeeshan likes Senorita Shawn Mendes, also Avengers Endgame, Zeeshan's movie. And Niranjana thankfully agrees with both of us with our movie picks. She says, I loved O-U-A-T-I-H. I had to Google that and then I realised that what it is...
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Thank you. Also enjoyed the Spider-Verse comic book animation.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Let's get some more insights now on the real estate market. And that is because new research from ValueStrat says home prices in Dubai are down about 11% this year. Peak to trough, since 2014, they are down 33%. Let's find out the story behind those numbers now. Joining us in the studio, I'm delighted to say, is the head of real estate research at ValueStrat, Haider Tuema. Now, there's a good news story here, which is that you think that the market will turn a corner in 2020. And we will get to that. But first of all, those figures about the decline in the market over the past 12 months. In simple terms, what has been driving those declines according to your research?
Well, as we've already been hearing, I'm sure in many reports, we've been talking about oversupply. We've been talking job losses. We've been talking about a lot of negative stuff, but unfortunately, the positive stuff is not really talked about much.
Yeah, no news is good news. The first rule of journalism school, isn't it? Day one, morning one. If it bleeds, it leads. That's probably our fault.
If we go back, I mean, I've been here about more than 20 years now. If we go back to 2007, 2008, and I remember sentiment was always that the market will continue to go up and up and up. And as we know, real estate goes through a cycle. The market has to go through a cycle and cannot go up indefinitely. The same thing at this point of time. The prices and rents cannot go down indefinitely, and it does go through a cycle. So we cannot just continue to think that it will continue to go down, and definitely not go down at the same rate.
But what you can have is a kind of Japanese-style lost two decades, where you have asset prices falling sharply and then staying down for 20 years or so. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that's kind of what we've seen in Japan for the past two decades, is it not?
Well, I don't like to compare this city with other cities, because Dubai is very, very unique, especially in terms of its demographics, where we have 90% of its population are as expats. And they're the ones who are driving the real estate market mostly, as well as international investors. So therefore, we are here on a temporary basis. We don't know whether we should buy a home, we should continue to rent. We don't know. In terms of job security, we don't know how long we're going to stay in the country. So it's a different dynamic altogether. This population is not growing based on birth. It's based on us coming into the country. And we are the majority, and we are the ones who govern the market in a way. We're 90%. So any other city in the world will depend on its natural population. And what we need, and also we can't, although we have just, I think you talked on the radio about the new visas and about the long-term visas, but most of us really are here for a short period of time. Well, for me, it's 20 years, probably a little bit more after that. But yeah, so if you compare with Japan, or you compare with New York, or you compare with Paris or with London, I think it's a very unique demographic situation, very unique economy. And we've only been, it's a very young market, we've only been through, I think, two cycles so far. So one of them was back in 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10. And the next one was 12, 13, 14, 15. And now we are seeing a slowing rate of decline.
So if we get onto what's going to happen next year and the green shoots potentially, and you say that there are green shoots in the market, as a homeowner, I'm hoping you're right. So I'm on your side with this. But to play devil's advocate, I would say we still have an oversupply of real estate and a very strong pipeline of new deliveries. We still have a lukewarm economy and rather than a booming economy. So against that backdrop, rising supply and fairly lukewarm demand, how can you forecast some kind of recovery in the real estate market? I'm interested to hear that argument.
Okay, first of all, what we have forecasted is not exactly a full turnaround. What we forecasted is a softening next year, and probably a flattening in 2021. But that in its own is considered positive. Now, coming back to supply, for anyone, any of the listeners would remember back in 2013 and how the prices were going up and the rents, and continued to increase throughout 2014 until it peaked in mid-2014. The supply back then, and not many analysts have talked about this, we had about 80,000 to 90,000 units oversupplied.
This was when?
This is 2013 and 2014.
Okay. 80,000 oversupply.
80,000 to 90,000 units oversupply. According to our calculations this time around, with this cycle, we're talking about 35,000 to 60,000 units oversupply. So yes, there is an oversupply. Yes, there's a lot of concrete being poured in. And yes, we do have this issue. But I think it is more of, the market is mostly sentimental. So a little bit of positive news will definitely move the market up. And next year, we're having the Expo 2020. And I think, and many analysts will agree with me, that this will definitely turn the market around.
Why would it turn the market around? Let's say we hit our target of 25 million visitors. They're not going to all buy an Azizi apartment or a Damac apartment, are they?
No, they're not. But even if it's a small portion of them who either open a business here in this country, or they find a job here, or decide to stay here, they will be looking for a property. So whether they want to rent an Azizi apartment who someone else might have bought, or to actually buy one. So yes, there will be a difference. See, this same argument we had back in 2009 when we had huge amounts of oversupply. Nobody was imagining that Dubai Marina will be occupied, or Jumeirah Lake Towers. And where are we right now? So it's just a matter of time. And
very quickly, we are short of time. In terms of, we've got oversupply at the moment. One of the things that happens in many real estate markets is that some of the second and third and fourth tier stock becomes replaced by the new stock. And that gets demolished, for want of a better word. The tower blocks just get, they're past their economic life. I'm thinking maybe of some tower blocks from the 70s and 80s in parts of Bur Dubai or Deira or Qusais. Could we see that happening and that real estate being repurposed and taking that supply off the market? Is that realistic?
It is possible. It is possible. And also the old stock could be renovated. We've seen this in other markets. But because Dubai is a young city, we don't see this too often. So usually everything is still brand new and shiny. So yeah, it's also possible.
Final question from me. Brandy Scott is thinking about buying an apartment in 2020 in Dubai. She's been thinking about it. She's been here as long as you have.
But she's been thinking about it for several decades.
Well, what do you think? Is 2020 the year to push the button for those who've been thinking about it for a while, long-term expats? Or should she wait another year or two, 2021, 2022?
Well, that's a typical question. I always get that. I will say, well, just focus on location. First of all, find a property that you like. And it's a buyer's market, which means you can definitely negotiate the price down, probably 10, perhaps up to 20%. And you are basically safe for the future because we don't expect any more declines of that kind of magnitude coming soon.
There you go. Under the Christmas tree on the 25th morning, a nice two-bedroom apartment overlooking a golf course. Haider Tuema, Head of Real Estate Research, Value Strat. Appreciate your time. Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
That is it for the Bite Size Business Breakfast. We're back tomorrow morning live on air, 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.